My father taught me very early that he said, when you hear Count Basie, you'll know it's Count Basie. Mm. You'll know it's nobody else. And he was absolutely right. That was Count Basie. And it just sounds great. That'll be the music we'll play this morning. Good morning. Welcome. It's Monday. It's the 22nd of April. I hope you all had a very nice weekend. And it was, whether you were working or not working or relaxing or traveling or whatever you were doing, that you enjoyed that pursuit. And we are back here for another work week, and we begin on this Monday with a panel filled with really great panelists to talk about the issues of the day. A quick little side note and a thank you from the bottom of my heart. I just want to thank all of the folks who took part in Friday's broadcast. We had a blast. It was a really, really good show. We had seven amazing women who were on the panel. We had a room filled with WAMC listeners and supporters. And we had an amazing staff who just did a wildly great job of getting everything together. And it was really special and meaningful. And I said it on the air then, but I'll say it on the air now. It's just you get that many people together in a room talking about really important things. And it was very special. I thought everyone had their moments of brilliance. They would have had more if there weren't seven of them. But
this is true.
But yes, and everybody played nice together and were working off each other, and it was really a great time. Libby was part of it, and I thank you very much.
Well, I'm so happy to hear you say that it was important issues, because we were talking mostly about women's issues, and women's issues never really reached that level of importance. For people to think about it. And there was one guy who asked the panel what men can do to help women. And I said, don't interrupt us, but then to stand with us and to be messengers on issues, as in, like, black...
I think that was me.
No. It was a guy in the audience with the white hair and a beard.
Oh, there was also the one that called you all ladies.
Yeah, well, there was that.
That
too.
Didn't go over well.
Yeah, but you know, when you have, you know, Sienna talked about the issue of black maternal mortality, and I said, what's important here is when you have different messengers speaking up and carrying the message about the importance of these issues. I said, if white men stood up and talked about the issue of black maternal mortality more, it would get the kind of attention it deserves, because this is the kind of country we live in.
Well, it was a really great 2-hour span of time. If you missed it and you would like to hear it, it is available on our website. Just go to wamc.org/roundtable, wamc.org/roundtable, and you can find the full program there, and it's worth listening. It will be second best to today's show.
Absolutely.
So let us get on with today's show. And the voice you just heard is that of political consultant and lobbyist Libby Post. Good morning, Libby.
Good morning.
Good to have you here. We also welcome John Faso, former New York 19 congressman and state rep. Hello, how are you?
Terrific. It's great to be here. It's not feeling much like spring this morning, but hope springs eternal. It's going to get warmer later this week, I understand.
It is. We'll wait for it. Believe it when we see it, feel it, but that's fine.
It'll come before we know it.
That's right. That will be very nice to have that warmth. John, thank you for being here. Mark Whitman is with us. It's family day for the Whitmans. Family day here at WAMC. Mark Whitman is here. His brilliant son George is with us, and we are thrilled to have you both here.
Thanks, Joe. George had off, so we asked him to come on up with us.
You know, Joe, I'm pretty happy. I don't have school today, and unlike Trump, I don't have to appear in court, so I can be here.
And good. Why don't you have school today?
I genuinely do not remember.
Was it a snow day that didn't get used?
Is it Passover?
Oh, it's Passover.
They call it a spring weekend, but I think it also is in deference to those who have Passover this evening.
Yeah, it starts tonight.
Yeah.
And it really should be you have off tomorrow, but that's okay. Everybody's got to be cooking.
Georgia, take both days off.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'll take that.
I mean, it starts tonight, so it's really Tuesday and Wednesday during the day.
Not going to fight.
Go for it.
You are 10 or 11?
11 now, Joe.
11 years old. George is a semi-regular in the program. We're thrilled to have him here. We keep his mic open, and he can jump in whenever he wants to. He always adds a lot to the conversation, and he's just a terrific. He's like our good luck charm as we do these programs. So thank you for being here. All right, everyone, let us get started. A lot to do. We have a lot to talk about, and we have a lot to talk about also because we had a special show on Friday, as we mentioned, and we didn't talk a lot about the news of the day then, so we'll talk a lot about the news of the day today. The Trump trial begins. The story we would have talked about is jury selection on Friday. That is completed now, and today we'll see opening statements in the people of the state of New York versus Donald J. Trump. The state's case seems strong, but a conviction is far from assured. This from the New York Times. In the official record, the case is known as the people of the state of New York versus Donald Trump. And for now, we have the stronger hand. The people have the stronger hand, rather. They have insider witnesses, a favorable jury pool, and a lurid set of facts about a presidential candidate, a payoff, and a porn star. On Monday, the prosecutors will formally introduce the case to 12 all-important jurors, embarking on the first prosecution of an American president. The trial, which could brand Mr. Trump a felon as he mounts another White House run, will reverberate throughout the nation and test the durability of the justice system that Mr. Trump is attacking in a way that no other defendant would be allowed to do. Though the district attorney Alvin Bragg has assembled a mountain of evidence, a conviction is hardly assured. Over the next 6 weeks, Mr. Trump's lawyers will seize on three apparent weak points: a key witness's credibility, a president's culpability, and the case's legal complexity. Prosecutors will seek to maneuver around those vulnerabilities, dazzling the jury with a tale that mixes politics and sex, as they confront a shrewd defendant with a decades-long track record of skirting legal consequences. They will also seek to bolster the credibility of that key witness, Michael Cohen, a former fixer to Mr. Trump, who previously pleaded guilty to federal crimes for paying the porn star Stormy Daniels. Much more to talk about as far as this case, but let us pause there and get the initial thoughts of our panel this morning. Mark Whitman.
Thanks, Joe. You asked me about this case a week ago, and I want to offer all the listeners a money back on my answer. Because I did some reading about this over the weekend, and I'm actually going to turn it over to John pretty quickly, so let me warn him, because we talked about this before we were getting on the air. The New York Times.
Damn it, Libby, we missed rehearsal again.
That's all right. I was here. You know, it's nothing new.
Okay, go ahead.
The New York Times paints an apt picture of a carnival. I mean, you've got a couple of ladies on trapeze. You've got a carnival barker and all sorts of clowns involved in this. But there's one problem that the New York Times has covered before. If you look back about 3 years ago, they actually had an editorial by Jed. I might pronounce his name wrong. By Jed Shugman, who talked about the legal foundations of this case, specifically the legal foundations of this case that turn what should be a state misdemeanor or a few state misdemeanors into a felony. And frankly, everyone who listens to this program regularly knows I am no fan of Donald Trump. I'm happy to see him face the full legal consequences for illegal actions once he's convicted. But the grounds on which the prosecutor is trying to supercharge this into a felony are really poorly based. And maybe at that point, I should ask John to give his view, since he's a lawyer and has a better background in this. But I'm happy to see the guy convicted of the misdemeanors. But the felony theory here is pretty weak. And I think it is so weak that it does really speak to the concerns that some have that Bragg went after Donald Trump because he is Donald Trump, and it makes me uncomfortable.
John Fasso.
Well, I think Mark has said it accurately, as he normally does. Let's be clear. The false bookkeeping, false business records charge is a misdemeanor under New York law. it is leapfrogged into a felony because it purportedly included a violation of a separate law. Well, what is that separate law? Alvin Bragg never fully delineates that in his legal papers, but the separate law is the federal campaign finance law. So he is alleging that the payments that were made to two individuals were, and it's commonly called hush money by the media, but the payments were made pursuant to a non-disclosure agreement, which is perfectly lawful. Trump used his own resources to pay those payments. They filtered it through a secretive type arrangement through Michael Cohen. Michael Cohen received the $130,000 that he had paid to Stormy Daniels. He received $260,000 in payments from Trump so that he could pay taxes on the payments that he received from Trump. And the point is that the Trump did not use campaign funds to pay this. If he had, that would have been a violation of federal campaign law. Alvin Bragg, as a state prosecutor, has no authority to prosecute a case involving federal campaign finance laws. Both the FEC and the federal prosecutors looked at this and decided that it would not stand up to legal scrutiny. Indeed, the John Edwards case a few years ago of the former North Carolina senator running for president, who had a similar inappropriate relationship with a woman who had a child, through a campaign donor of John Edwards, paid a fee or a fund or an amount to this woman that was prosecuted by the federal prosecutors as a campaign finance violation.
I know this doesn't matter, John, but I just have to jump in and say he did that while his wife had cancer. And he broke up with her via fax.
Yeah.
Go on.
Broke up so, with his wife? Broke
it was,
with his wife.
It was a and, you know, probably the similarity in both cases, the Trump and the Edwards case, is that both were sleazy transactions for reasons that they wanted to keep the allegations of the woman's secret. They wanted to buy her secrecy. A non-disclosure agreement is not a crime. It's typically done. It's very common. And if Alvin Bragg is able to leapfrog a state misdemeanor charge on bookkeeping into a felony, there's something very, very wrong. And it appears that Alvin Bragg is doing this because politically, he doesn't like Trump, and obviously most of the people in Manhattan don't like Trump. He got under 20% of the vote in the presidential election in 2020. So the fact is that we have a case that is brought by a prosecutor who's leapfrogging this into a felony. And by the way, one other point, there are 34 felony charges alleged here.
Correct.
If this were the Department of Justice, they would not permit the prosecutor to magnify these number of charges in this way. There really are three separate charges or transactions. One is the payment of Trump to Cohen, the payment, the illegal or the misrepresentation of the business records is the third, and then the payments that Trump then made to reimburse Cohen for the amounts that he paid. So there are three separate charges, but under the federal system, the Department of Justice wouldn't allow a prosecutor to multiply these number of charges to make it look even worse to the average person out there. And that's exactly what Alvin Bragg has done here. So it's really a shame because Lady Justice is blind. When she's holding up the scales of justice, she's blindfolded. And the law should apply to people, whether we like them or don't like them, whether they're sleazy or they're not sleazy. And unfortunately, I don't think that's the case here.
So I want to go to Libby. I do want to just throw in that the Siena College poll out today says New Yorkers say Trump's Manhattan trial is legitimate, 54% to 30%, more than three quarters of Dems and a plurality of independents say that it is indeed legitimate, with Republicans calling, the majority of Republicans calling it a witch hunt. Libby.
Well, you know, I'm not a lawyer and I don't play one on TV. And I get what both Mark and John are saying. It's beyond sleazy, though, John. It's really, this man is a crook. This man is a racist. This man is not what we need to be representing the United States on the world stage. My attitude is whatever can be done to knock him down in any way. You know, this is going to be, unfortunately, New York is going to go blue. So this case is not going to impact the outcome of the presidential election here in New York because it's going to go blue. The electoral votes are going to go to Donald Trump. What he'll be able to do, unfortunately, is use it in those swing states.
The
where,
electoral votes will go to Joe Biden.
Right. Huh?
Electoral votes will go to Joe Biden.
In New York. Trump will be able to use it in those swing states to rally his base of people who don't trust government, period, and to say, look, they're going after me and blah, 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 blah. The usual playing the victim that he does so well to then screw everybody else. So, you know, the man is a liar. The man is a cheat. He is not fit to be the president of the United States. I think the 4 years he was in the presidency shows that. You know, we'll see what happens with this case. You know, maybe things will work out where he is convicted. We'll see.
We will see. We'll talk about it more when we come back on the other side of the break. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org will return after this news from the BBC. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. And we welcome you, panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. And we've been talking about just moments from now, opening statements in the first Trump criminal trial will begin. And we've been talking about the merits of the case and how our panelists feel about that. So, Mark, is there anything you wanted to add to what both you and John were saying?
I would love to see Trump rightfully held to account for what he's done. My concern, particularly with this case, is even if he were to be convicted of the felony, by the time you're done with appeals, particularly if you start getting into the federal system, that'll be a race. And I'm not sure that does what those who want to tarnish Trump's image want. I think that'll actually, the risk is it bolsters his image amongst at least his faithful, if not others. So I think there are much better cases out there. I think, you know, what he did in Georgia, frankly, that phone call, if it wasn't illegal, should be. You wouldn't let somebody do that if they were running for student council, to call up the person counting votes and, right, and start to try and influence it. I think there are plenty of other places where he needs to be held to account legally. We'll get to one if we talk about his bond today, too. But I don't think this case, unfortunately, is all that serious. And I think that gets lost when the circus that CNN and, frankly, even The Times, which have rightfully run some pieces about the poor undergirding of this legally, they've sort of ignored that now, and they're focused on the circus. I'm afraid the tent's going to collapse before this is over.
And when you say 10 collapse, just so I know, that they will not get a conviction or there'll be a mistrial or any of the above?
I think the facts that he falsified business records, I suspect he's guilty of that and he'll be proven guilty of that, particularly in front of a Manhattan jury. Depending on how the jury instructions are given, this power up to a federal offense, I think, is more suspicious. But even if he's convicted of it, I think the odds that it stands on appeal are minuscule. So at some point, I think the circus tent comes down.
Let's go to our letters and find out what is on the minds of our listeners. David writes, as despicable as I find Donald Trump to be, I found Mr. Fasso's comments to be very compelling in support of the rule of law over political persecution. Then John says, I sit here listening, as I have since Donald Trump entered our political consciences, and marvel at how, even after all that's happened, some still choose to find any excuse they can to argue why he should not be held responsible for anything he does. While it comes couched in technical legalities or whataboutisms, there are too many just too willing to keep giving him a pass. Well, I think you would agree, John, not you, John Faso, but John the listener, that you would want, if you have a conviction, that's done in the merits of the law and you go through the process.
Yeah, I mean, so much of the people cheerleading on this prosecution are doing so because they don't like Trump. They don't want him to be elected. And look, being sleazy is not a crime. You know, in fact, think of it this way. Had Trump come forward with the request from one of these women to make a payment, if you don't make this payment, I'm going to go public with it. I mean, if he had gone to prosecutors, would Alvin Bragg have prosecuted that? I mean, that sounds like garden variety extortion to me. It's pretty obvious that Trump has done a number of things that don't comport with one's standard of moral behavior. But again, the question is whether these rise to the nature of a criminal offense. And perhaps the jury, as Mark was alluding to, will convict him only of the misdemeanor. I don't know if that'll be an option for them at that point. But again, Alvin Bragg doesn't have the authority to prosecute a federal campaign finance violation. And just think of it in terms of the reverse. If Trump had used his campaign money to pay Michael Cohen in order to pay Stormy Daniels, et cetera, that clearly would have been a campaign finance violation. So, but he didn't do that. He used his own money. And again, non-disclosure agreements, even if it's a sleazy arrangement like this or if it's a regular business dispute, are very commonplace. They are not illegal. So I think the problem here is that Alvin Bragg, and look, Alvin Bragg is not prosecuting certain crimes in New York City of a violent nature. And you look at what's going on at Columbia University right now. Is Alvin Bragg going to prosecute those cases to the fullest extent of the law? It does raise a question about a double standard. And I think everyone should be accountable to the law. But we can't, in this country, turn ourselves and our legal system into something akin to a banana republic where we prosecute people just because we don't like them or politically we have disagreements with them. That sets us down a slippery slope that is extraordinarily dangerous, it seems to me.
Marie says if the charges against Donald Trump are bogus and politically motivated, then why did Michael Cohen go to jail for 3 years? Election interference is a crime.
It's very interesting that the listener brings up the Michael Cohen. Michael Cohen pled guilty to campaign finance violations, which most independently judging of this lawyers would look at it and say he didn't really commit a campaign finance violation at all. What Michael Cohen was pressured by prosecutors because Michael Cohen was engaged in financial transactions dealing with New York City taxi medallions. And the feds had him to rights on all sorts of financial and banking law violations, for which he did not plead guilty to, but he pled guilty to something because they were hoping that they could leapfrog that into a prosecution of Trump. And that's, again, Michael Cohen the other day, just recently, in front of a federal court, said that he lied when he said he pled guilty to the campaign finance violations that the listener just alluded to.
I think it's also worth mentioning, if I'm correct, that Cohen also faced charges of lying to Congress.
Correct.
Which were also hanging over his head. I actually looked at this over the weekend. For any listener who wants to come to a different conclusion, I'm happy to be proven wrong, but I tried really hard to picture Trump in a black and white striped jumpsuit.
It's orange now.
Okay, thank you. Orange jumpsuit. But I couldn't get there when I read about this. Remember also, Cyrus Vance declined to prosecute this, who's Bragg's predecessor. Now there's an assertion amongst the apologists that Bragg's found some extra special information that wasn't available to Vance, and maybe we'll see that in the court. I'm going to wince until I hear something that I'm not aware of from Bragg about the whole of this case.
So this is from Christopher on that point. despite John Faso's partisan rant, we'll put that aside, but both federal Judge Alvin Hellerstein and Judge Merchan have determined that Alvin Bragg's approach to the case is legally sound and permitted to proceed. End of story. Let the jury decide.
That's where we are, and then it's going to get appealed, and then we'll see what happens.
Then we go to Stuart. The panel's focus on the allegations of federal election law violence as the aggravating factor in the Trump case. However, the DA also has suggested other aggravating crimes that, if proven, would seem to offer a much more solid basis for a felony conviction, particularly state tax law violations. The characterization of a non-deductible personal expense as a deductible legal fee would seem to be enough if the DA can prove Trump deducted the expenses on his taxes.
And that wouldn't be a felony. And the interesting thing is that, there's also the question of whether Michael Cohen properly accounted for this on his tax filings. And yet Trump paid Michael Cohen $260,000 to plus up the $130,000 that Michael Cohen paid Stephanie Clifford, a.k.a. Stormy Daniels. And I've yet to find someone who gets convicted for overpaying their taxes.
I also looked at that issue over the weekend, and you haven't heard the tax piece mentioned that often. And if you remember, Trump paid very little taxes for the years right before his presidency. I suspect if you crawled inside his tax returns, by the time the Rube Goldberg machine shakes it all out, how he accounted for these particular transactions mattered so little that I'm sure it wouldn't be a felony. And I'm not even sure, you know, the class misdemeanor would be all that important either, frankly. In other words, you can, if I lied about on my taxes about a fact that never affects what I pay to the government, it's unlikely they're going to come after me with all that much vigor. And I think that may be what happened with respect to Trump's taxes. I'm surmising that because if it were a big tax issue, you'd have heard about it because Bragg's stretching everything he's got.
David writes, come on, John. If it was all so legit, why didn't Trump just write the $130,000 check directly to Stormy Daniels? Why the subterfuge? And why wouldn't a skinflint like Trump be so amenable to paying $260,000 to Cohen twice the amount he could have gotten away with in a direct payment? Answer, he's a crook.
The answer is he wanted to hide the payment of a non-disclosure agreement. And again, non-disclosure agreements are not illegal. They're commonly done in all sorts of business and other transactions. So it really, I mean, people really need to separate their hatred and dislike with Donald Trump and his record, whatever, from the question of should he be treated the same as anyone else under the law. And if this person's defendant's name was not Donald Trump, I highly doubt Alvin Bragg would be bringing felony charges for a misdemeanor state business records transaction.
Let's go to one or two more letters, and then we'll take a break and come back. Irene says being sleazy isn't a crime, but for presidential candidates and a president, it is despicable. What is dangerous is having a president that disrespects the office they hold. Trump has committed crimes. He just hasn't been held accountable.
It's about character.
Then Peter says sleaze is not a crime, according to John. This ranks alongside corporations are people, my friend. How about we get some politicians who model honorable behavior?
Well, I mean, this is a standard trope of folks on the left about corporations. Corporations business entities to set up in order to conduct business. And corporations.
And are they alive so that they have freedom of speech?
No, but corporations do have freedom of speech,
right,
actually.
I know. And look what it's done to our political system. Citizens United has undermined the credibility of our political system.
Well, I haven't finished, then I'll come to you.
No. Corporations are legal entities set up by people in order to conduct business. And that's how they've always been. And there's nothing shocking about it. Corporations have free speech rights, but they're not living human persons. But under the law, they're treated that way for all sorts of legitimate reasons. And, you know, complaining about corporations aren't people is kind of a non sequitur.
You know, I have a corporation. I have two, right? Both of my businesses are corporate structures. That doesn't mean I can use all of the money, all the profits, to destroy the political system. Now, Citizens United, giving corporations the carte blanche to be able to spend as much money as they want to impact the political system, has undermined the credibility of our body politic. I don't think, I know you'll disagree with me, but I don't think any other thinking person would necessarily disagree with that because
of
where we are. Because of where we are. Look at where we are. Look at where we are. We have Donald Trump who could possibly be reelected. Corporate money will be behind him, as will the money of the white Christian nationalists in this country. And, you know, John, I'm still sort of sitting here. I know we need to take a break soon, but I'm still sort of sitting here wondering the hit you took at Alvin Bragg, saying he doesn't prosecute violent crime, and then what is he going to do about what happened at Columbia University over the weekend? There are two different things. I'm not happy with what happened at Columbia University this weekend. I'm Jewish. We all know that. This was outright anti-Semitism. But those people also have a right to their free speech. I might not agree with it, but they do have a right to their free speech. That's different than going after Alvin Bragg because of the laws that are on the books and called bail reform.
All right, let's take a break. When we come back, we will we'll work some of this out in our time. Last letter before we go to a break. Steve writes, John and Mark's cogent arguments are messing with my schadenfreude.
They messed with mine all weekend.
We'll be back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. I want to just say I'm going to put the Columbia story on hold just for a few minutes because we'll discuss that in full after the top of the hour. But Columbia University announced earlier today that it would hold classes remotely after a wave of agitated protests on campus over the weekend that drew widespread attention from city and national officials and raised safety concerns for some Jewish students. We will also talk about what Stanford University, USC is going through as well. So we'll touch on that. In the moments before we go to the top of the hour, I would like to talk about another Trump legal thing, and that is the bond that is for the earlier Trump case of the E. Jean Carroll case. And so the New York Attorney General's office has asked a judge to void the $175 million bond that former President Trump secured to put off paying the larger monetary damage award in his civil fraud case. State lawyers said in court filings that the former president and his co-defendants, the Trump Organization and its top executives, including his two eldest sons, failed to prove the surety that Trump used to obtain the bond actually has the money to back it. They also say the defendants did not show that sufficiently secure and ascertainable collateral backs the bond. Based on the foregoing, the public respectfully requests that the court deny the motion to justify the surety, declare the bond to be without effect, and order that any replacement bond be posted within 7 days. Trump's bond was secured by the California-based Knight Specialty Insurance Company. State lawyers argued Knight is a small insurer that is not authorized to write business in New York, and until Trump had never before written a surety bond in New York. This is another one you looked at closely, Mark.
Yeah, let me tell you, just to prove that I have a balanced view of Trump, there is no way the court should accept the bond, the alleged bond that was written and that Trump submitted. It's a joke. If I, as a junior banker years ago had gone out, and if the assignment was to get a bond that made the New York State safe, if Trump can't pay, and I came back with this is the answer. There's a good chance I would have been sent home, never to return to the bank I was working at. This outfit that he used, I mean, not only have they not underwritten surety bonds in New York, it's been a few years since they've done them in any states. The capital surplus that they have would entitle them to maybe write a bond of about $14 million, not $170. The obligation, as I understand it, has been handed over to a Cayman Islands company. So if all goes wrong, you're going to have to go after it. I heard a report that said that Trump had actually, that they'd submitted as part of the bond a screenshot of account that currently has $175 million in it, but that Trump can take money out and hypothetically replace with stock, which is not financially sound. You may end up with that Trump media stock, which could be worth cents on the dollars within moments of him putting it in the account. And further, the institution, the Knight Securities that he's dealing with, or the Knight Insurance Company that he's dealing with, has been found deficient in terms of their legal activity a number of times over the past few years by the feds. Letitia James should prevail on this point, and Trump should be forced to either put a real bond in place or the court should take other action. And if the court doesn't do that, the court's being played for a chump.
George?
You know, Joe, I found a bond just like the one Trump used at breakfast this morning. It was in the bottom of my cereal box.
Yeah, there you go.
A toy.
It's about that bad. It's barely worth the paper it's written on.
Well, but it looked pretty, didn't it? Yeah, it looked good.
Not really.
No, kind of odie. Yeah. But the issue is, too, here that it is, okay, then what happens next? Because it seems... Oh, and I may get in trouble for saying this from our listeners, but I'll say it anyway, which is, to your point about Alvin Bragg, John Faso, my concern here would be that if this is a question being questioned by the AG, that it also seems like they're just priming to want to take properties away.
I agree. It does seem like the AG wants to do that. Remember when the first amount of the bond was the entire amount of the settlement, I said that was excessive. The Trump's problem now is he hasn't complained about the amount of this bond, so he's going to be stuck with this amount. He's got other ways of fulfilling the bond hypothetically, or he can start to talk about giving title to the AG to some of his properties, which will be complicated because some of them are held jointly. I don't know what his debt structure is like, but I suspect, despite some assertions to the opposite, that they're not all held free and clear of debt. So it will get complicated, but smart financial minds can get into a room and get the state of New York in a position where it feels comfortable that it really does have $178 million worth of insurance one way or the other. This bond is not that answer. It wouldn't be that answer for any human being. It's ridiculous.
But
if it's shown to be as fallacious as you say, what's the legal implications for Trump?
Well, hey, the AG has a remedy, which is you give him 7 days, and if not, then you start giving us title to properties.
Property.
I think that's a bit of a jump. I think she needs to sit in a room with his reasonable lawyers and accountants and start talking about making the New York State whole as with respect to having $178 million worth of comfort that's at least what they'll get out of Trump if the rest of his organization were to somehow disappear. There are ways to do this. The way the AG postures, I'm not sure. I haven't done this in court, so I'm not sure if it's purely posturing, if she really wants what she asks for. I think there's a better ask, but I presume she's asking for two in hopes of getting one. Right. And I think the court needs to force these parties.
And this is all civil.
Yeah, and it's, but I just want to be clear, this bond is no bond. I mean, it is almost, it's not worth the paper it's written on. It's laughable.
John,
yeah, I think Mark is correct in terms of the quality of the bond. The problem is that the value of commercial real estate has dropped precipitously in many places around the country because of the post-pandemic decline in occupancy in commercial real estate. So it is somewhat difficult to place valuations on some of these properties now. And again, I think this is another example, though, that whole prosecution where no one lost money. The people that gave the loans to Trump were all paid back. Is he the first real estate operator in New York to overvalue the assets? No, definitely not. But that was the judgment of the court. And ultimately, he's going to have to, as Mark said, come up with a bond that is going to meet the requirements, not of the $350 or $70 million that the ultimate judgment was, but the $175 million that the appellate court reduced it to. And his success in doing that right now, I think, is very much up in the air.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll go to several letters that we have on this issue, and then we'll move on to other topics as well. We welcome you all to join in. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We'll be back after this news with Ray Graff. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. John Faso, Libby Post, Mark Whitman, his son George, we're all here, and we welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. I'm going to go through some letters very quickly, and then we'll move on, but I do want to get to these four or five that we didn't get to in our first hour. Leslie writes, for Mark to say that this case is not serious demonstrates that he does not understand what it is about. It is commonly referred to as the hush money case, but he is actually being charged with falsifying business records for the purpose of interfering with the 2016 elections. These are highly serious alleged crimes and should be treated as such. Then we go to David, I agree with Libby's assessment of Trump's moral and ethical character and the reasons why he shouldn't be president. However, we must maintain equal application of the law regardless of his moral failings. To do anything less than that makes us no better than him. John writes, I sit here listening as I have since Donald Trump's entered our political consciousness. I already read that. I apologize. I did not put that in the right folder. Bruce says, why must the media constantly refer to Ms. Clifford as porn star Stormy Daniels rather than adult film actress and producer Stephanie Clifford? I'm a bit surprised Libby hasn't mentioned this. It's very demeaning to both Ms. Clifford and the case itself.
Okay.
And then we go to Nick. Considering Trump's penchant for threatening political violence and the threat of Trump acolytes, why is this jury not sequestered? I've wondered that myself, but I'm wondering if that may change, too, as things move on. I don't know. When we saw Friday's court action where two seated members were removed, because of the information mm-hmm. that was released. Let's go to Bob. John's claim that Trump's overvaluation of his properties when applying for loans caused no harm simply isn't true. The judge found a more accurate valuation would have resulted in $150 million more being paid to the lenders. Trump effectively stole that money, full stop. And the last letter we'll do on this is on Citizens United. It's from Terry to say corporations are people misses the point. Concrete human beings have motivation, not organizations. Citizens United turbocharges the motivation to do the wrong thing, hiding it behind the flag. No, hiding it behind the fig leaf of economic freedom. That from Terry. And Robert says, such great news. The $95 billion aid to Ukraine and Israel is in the process of passing. Even greater news is I realigned my investment to arms manufacturing before the senators and congresspeople did theirs. Oh, okay. All right. Yeah, I got that. Well, we'll talk about that in just a few just a few minutes. Thank you all for your letters. We welcome yours. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. All right, let's go to the story coming out of California. And as I mentioned, I will also circle in on this and look at the Columbia University case as well. But the University of Southern California, reeling after a controversy over its valedictorian selection, announced Friday that its main commencement program would eliminate outside speakers and honorees, including the director of Crazy Rich Asians, John Chu, and the tennis star, Billie Jean King. The private university in Los Angeles broke with tradition this week by announcing that its valedictorian, a first-generation Muslim student, would not deliver a commencement address on May 10th, a decision that came after campus Jewish organizations objected to her selection. The student groups, including Trojans for Israel, cited a pro-Palestinian social media link by the valedictorian, Asna Tabassum, who is of South Asian ancestry. After the groups announced their opposition, the university said it received a barrage of communications indicating that the commencement would be disrupted. Meanwhile, on the opposite coast, Columbia University announced early that it would hold classes remotely after a wave of agitated protests on campus over the weekend that drew widespread attention from city and national officials and raised safety concerns for some Jewish students. The university's president said in a letter to the Columbia community, "We need a reset," adding that she felt sadness about how the university's bonds had been severely tested in recent weeks. She urged students who do not live on campus not to travel there. The campus has been embroiled in protests since last week. On Wednesday, the president testified at a congressional hearing examining anti-Semitism at the university. Pro-Palestinian students erected dozens of tents on the central campus lawn, vowing to stay put until Columbia met demands, including divesting from companies with ties to Israel. On Thursday, after the students refused to stand down, the New York police arrested more than 100 of them. So two separate stories, but similar issues. Libby.
Well, all of this is happening on the eve of Passover. Tonight is the first night of Passover. And families, Jewish families and non-Jews who will be at Seder tables will recite the story of Jews being released from bondage in Egypt and eventually finding their way to Israel. I mean, that's what happened. We wandered for 40 years because of various circumstances per the biblical story.
There was no GPS back then.
Yeah, they had no GPS. And, you know, somebody did something that God didn't like, and so he made us wander for 40 years. And the generations, it had to do with the golden calf. So the generations would, wouldn't be there. The new generations would be the ones to come into Israel. And so all of this is happening with that as a backdrop. And the virulent rise in anti-Semitism in this country. That's my biggest concern here. What's happening at Harvard, what's happening at USC, I think everybody has a right to express their opinion. It's the First Amendment. The ACLU is, supporting everybody who wants to speak out about what's going on in Israel and Gaza. I believe in the First Amendment. What I don't believe in is hate speech. And it bleeds over quite a bit when it comes to Israel. I've said this before, I will say it again. It takes a really fine mind to know the distinction between anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism. And for folks who don't get it, which is the majority of the folks protesting, this turns into anti-Semitism in a heartbeat. And so what happens is Jewish students in Columbia don't feel safe. swastikas are written on whiteboards and in college campuses all across the country. Jewish student groups are targeted. You know, all kinds of things happen because people see, okay, here's the state of Israel. It's a Jewish state, so all and they're not doing what I want them to do. They're being bad, all right? Israel's being bad, what's happening in Gaza, Rafah, all of that. And so that means all Jews are bad. And so people take that perspective, and it turns into anti-Semitism here and in other countries all around the world. And, you know, we've experienced this our entire existence. Hatred of Jews and hatred of women are the two oldest hatreds in the world. And, you know, we will, first of all, people need to understand that we're not going anywhere unless you do what Hitler did, which I know that there are some people who would like to do that. But we're not going anywhere. We're continuing to be here. The Jewish community is vibrant. It's small. That's the other thing. It's small. It's really, really small. We have the biggest Jewish community is in New York City and New York, then by de facto New York State, California. But other than that, you know, there aren't that many of us worldwide. And so we are now have become this big threat just by our mere existence and by Israel's existence. I do not support Netanyahu. I do not support what he has done. I think he has to go. But I think when you talk about ceasefire, what really needs to happen is let's talk about getting rid of Hamas, because Hamas are not freedom fighters. Hamas put children, use children like George as human shields. They use hospitals as human shields. They are not a representative of the Palestinian people. They were elected in 2014. There hasn't been a democratic election since. So it's really about getting rid of Hamas. If we want to talk about a ceasefire, we have to talk about getting rid of Hamas and recognizing the role that Iran has played in all of this and other Arab countries that have played in this who want to see Israel destroyed. I do not want to see Israel destroyed. I want Israel to be, to become and to reclaim its democracy and its that it is a shining bright light of democracy in the Middle East. It's the only one. But, you know, you talk about a ceasefire, you also have to talk about getting rid of Hamas. And that's not happening because people see Hamas as freedom fighters, and they're not. They're terrorists. They use sexual violence on October 7th. No one's speaking out about that. I've been speaking out about it a lot because they used rape as a weapon of war against women. And now the talk about the hostages being released, I don't think they know where they are. And I think that most of them aren't alive anymore. I think
being a human shield does not sound fun.
No, it's not. And that's what they've done. They use people as human shields. So that's where I'm at in all of this. It's incredibly hurtful and painful.
What should the institutions like Columbia do in response to the very hateful rhetoric that's coming from purportedly students and others at places like Columbia?
Well, I think that there needs to be speak outs where that are well facilitated, giving everybody the opportunity to speak. But there also needs to be public education about what anti-Semitism is, what anti-Zionism is, what the difference should be if anybody can. I consider it to be a distinction without a difference about 99% of the time. They're academic institutions. Should be about learning and freedom of speech. It's a very difficult position to be in. I can tell you at UAlbany, there hasn't been this kind of hatred as we have down in New York City and in some of the major urban areas. You know, it's about about respect.
But if the we all believe in free speech, etc. But if certain students perpetuate disruption of classes, disruption of academic activity, and spew vile and hateful things towards fellow students. What is the responsibility of the university? What should they do?
Well, here's the deal. Title VI of the Civil Rights Act considers Jews to be an ethnic group, and we are. We're Semites. You know, we are an ethnic group, and that alone is enough to shut down the hate speech and to take action against the students who are doing what they're doing, the hate speech that they're doing, and the violence. I mean, that's the other part of this. You know, kids, you know, how bizarre is it, or how horrible is it, that a student who is Orthodox, right, and is at Columbia, feels that they can't wear their yarmulke anymore because they're going to be targeted.
Well, shouldn't the universities either suspend or expel those students?
Yeah, I think that there has to be some action taken around the violence. The shutting down of the classrooms, I mean, I remember what it was like during the Vietnam War. I was a kid, but I remember, right? And I marched in those wars, and I know, I mean, I watched March Against the War, and I know what the SDS did. And while some of it was violent, and I don't think at this point called for, that those actions led to the ending of the Vietnam War. And so we have to recognize that what happens on a college campus with young people can have an impact on our body politic and, you know, what can happen. But this was the United States' war. This is Israel's war. Yes, we're supporting Israel because they are our ally in the Middle East. But if someone's violent and foments violence, I don't think they should be on campus anymore.
I want to get to Mark on this, but also bring in the USC case of what you do when you have commencement of not bringing of canceling your valedictorian and also not bringing in any speakers to campus.
Yeah, I think the USC case, because it's a little more straightforward, talks to both how regrettable it is that academic institutions are no longer safe places in which we can have spirited but reasonable debates. I mean, James Baldwin and William F. Buckley used to go at it, right? And at the end of it, they would shake hands, for God's sake. And so let's talk about what USC should have done with their speaker. Even though, by the way, she has a checkered history, if you look at her social media accounts of calling for things that are pretty extreme, they should have sat down with her, with a faculty advisor, and said, look, at USC, we criticize actions, not people, okay? We're going to check your speech. You can be critical of actions. You cannot be critical of people. Your speech is going to have a time limit. You're going to tell us that you're going to stay true to the length of your speech. And you'd be, if you're USC, you're smart about it. You put her on a microphone that you can shut off if she goes too long, right? Or if she goes off script, as it were. I mean, you can't let her abuse the privilege. But totally excluding her, frankly, smacks of racism. There are plenty of people I can tell you about who were the first African-American valedictorian of their academic institution and never got recognized or got allowed to speak. It sounds bad. The other thing is USC has hosted presidents, so this claim that we can't provide security is nonsense. And before you so break with tradition as to shut her down, if you say to yourself, gee, there's one group in this debate that's going to be uncomfortable sitting with their kids and their parents for 10 minutes listening to her speech, you say, you know what, before we shut her down, the option is maybe we ask her if she's got a friend who's got the other side, and we make a special exception and let them present to us, right, and ask them to work their speeches in unison with one another. But before you shut her down, there are so many steps that the university should have taken to foster reasonable discussion of these topics that it's really sad what they did. And if you look at it, in the end, right, they're shutting down a notable director, and they're shutting down, as a result of it, they're shutting down Billie Jean King.
Right.
Right. I mean,
right.
What a loss for everybody who would have been in attendance that day.
Well, and just the celebration of commencement. I mean, what it's supposed to be, and that's completely off the radar now.
I mean, they've blown it. Unless you tell me that they've taken the steps that I just outlined or similar steps and we just didn't hear about it and they couldn't come to terms, they've blown it. And what they've done in blowing it is the Columbia situation is a lot, if I will, it's a lot messier. It's a little bit harder to go through the delineated steps that you take. But look, the other thing I must say is I was – my stomach turned over the weekend when apparently Ilhan Omar's daughter is a student at Bard who got swept up in some of the arrests.
Barnard,
thank you. Who got swept up in some of the arrests, and now her and others like AOC are basically trying to come out and criticize Columbia publicly. You know what? If your child gets involved in a protest like that and they roll the dice and they get arrested, you might want to congratulate them privately as long as they weren't doing something that was violent. I mean, if they're sort of like, we're not going to move our tent, go ahead and arrest me. If it's some sort of nonviolent offense, you might want to – but you can't claim that they were somehow mistreated or get all upset about it. You know, it's okay every once in a while, as I say to my son, when you're playing hockey to get put in the penalty box. But you as a parent should be stepping in complaining, particularly if you're a representative. And it just shows how burdened what are pretty simple steps that colleges and universities should take to regulate behavior are with all this political foment that they shouldn't be. And it's too bad they can't get it back to some reasonable sense of fostering debate.
And, you know, back to the USC issue, USC should just pull a COVID-19 and do graduation on Zoom.
Well, it would solve a lot. I mean, it would solve some problems as far as if what they're saying, that security is the reason, but I find it very difficult to believe that that's the reason.
You can protect President Obama, but you can't protect, come on.
But the Secret Service. But the Secret Service comes in and does the protection of the president. Let's be honest about that.
But they could protect the student.
Yeah, they can protect the student. I mean, look, this is just, I think every single university president right now is really nervous, right? They're very nervous. They saw what happened to Harvard. They saw what happened to the woman at the University of Pennsylvania. People are just really, I think they're all pretty nervous about all of this stuff and not wanting to get called onto the carpet by Elise Stefanik.
Who did exactly that to Columbia University the last week.
Right. Yeah. So I think, you know, I think that's part of it, too. But also not wanting there to be a violent incident at commencement.
Well, Elise pointed out correctly that Harvard and Penn and the other school wouldn't say that calling for the death and violence against Jews violated their code of conduct. And so she was absolutely correct in how she called out the president of Harvard and others over this topic.
So my question about the commencement speech itself, and I've been trying to find this, has anyone seen it? In other words, I mean, it is fairly standard, I believe, when a student or anyone, even the guest speakers, when they give an address, for it to be submitted to the faculty.
Right.
Not really for editing or for review, more than just to help put things in context and make sure that the proceedings go along relatively easily and there aren't any surprises. But to do this without having looked at it and think about what was said, and just because you're saying that this student is going to be the valedictorian, and then student groups getting upset by that fact and then shutting that down, I don't know. I don't know how you...
USC is not claiming that they saw a version that they couldn't stomach or that it wouldn't be edited, because, frankly, that's where they... If they'd have decided not to let her speak because she insisted on a text that was disagreeable to the university, I think we'd all say, hey, we get that. That's okay. But what they're saying they did was they're using this flimsy excuse of security. I understand the president has Secret Service, but if USC needs to ask LAPD to help them out, otherwise, frankly, you're just caving to these vague threats and shutting down what should be reasonable civic discourse as a result of threats. And I'm sorry, last time I checked, we're in the U.S. That's now how it's supposed to work.
But John, I just wanted to go back to your reveling of Elise Stefanik. She did this for political points, and that's it. I've never seen her at a Jewish event. I have never seen her as an ally to the Jewish community. She did this to make political points, and that's the only reason she did it.
Well, she is an ally of Israel and of the Jewish community, and
really,
regardless of whether you say it was a political point or not, it was a valid point. And she exposed the hypocrisy of these college presidents who, for whatever reason, simply were unable to call out students who were calling for the destruction of Israel and the destruction of Jews. I mean, it's just it was a simple question, and none of them could answer
answer. None of them were well prepped by.
You don't have to be prepped to say, you know, we shouldn't be calling for the death of
right.
Israel and the destruction of Jews.
But they also could have used Title VI as their legal backup. And
Libby, I'd recommend they consult with you ahead of time the next time.
Right. My understanding about what happened, by the way, is they were overprepared. They actually had spent too long with their lawyers. And the answer they gave, actually, if you look at it in its full length and in context, it checks the legal box, but it was a silly answer, right? Mm-hmm. And we all agree on that. In
politically
retrospect.
Dumb.
And John, I do think it's a little bit dangerous.
30 seconds, but go ahead.
To applaud Elise Stefanik. I think you have to do it in the context of she was auditioning to be Trump's vice president. You have to just.
That's right.
And yes, you know, she did find a truffle. But you have to realize the broad context in which she got it right.
Well, she did get it right. And I think that no one here is disputing the fact that she was correct in calling out these university presidents who were blind in their hypocrisy about what was being called for on their campuses.
I know. It's the Eastern elite. I get it.
Okay, we'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. Libby has to leave us.
Yes, I do.
But we wish you well.
Have
and thank
holiday.
You very much.
Thank you, thank you, thank you.
We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable and our last go-around with our panel. And we welcome you, panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. For weeks after the Senate passed a sprawling aid package for Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan, Speaker of the House Mike Johnson agonized over whether and how the House would take up funding legislation that would almost certainly infuriate the right wing of his party and perhaps could cost him his job. He huddled with top national security officials, including William Burns, the CIA director in the Oval Office, to discuss classified intelligence. He met repeatedly with broad factions of Republicans in both swing and deep red districts and considered their voters' attitudes toward funding Ukraine. He thought about his son, who is set to attend the U.S. Naval Academy in the fall. And finally, when his plan to work with Democrats to clear the way for aiding Ukraine met with an outpouring of venom from ultra-conservatives already threatening to depose him, Mr. Johnson, an evangelical Christian, knelt and prayed for guidance. I want to be on the right side of history, Representative Michael McCaul of Texas, the chairman of the Foreign Affairs Committee, recalled the speaker telling him. Mr. Johnson's decision to risk his speakership to push the $95 billion foreign aid bill through the House on Saturday was the culmination of a remarkable personal and political arc for the Louisiana Republican. John Fasso.
Well, I'm very glad that the House passed these aid measures the other day. I hope it's not too late. I don't think it will be, but in order to push back Putin and the Russian aggression, it's extraordinarily important that the United States continue to stand with Ukraine and to stand with our ally Israel and also to stand with our allies in the Indo-Pacific. And this measure will do all three. And it was critical. And Mike Johnson, I know Mike Johnson, he's a deeply conservative guy, but he's also someone who's deeply principled and honest. And he's a very decent person. And I think he came to this conclusion, which was contrary to where he earlier stood on the whole question of Ukraine. He came to this conclusion after the intelligence briefings and the evidence that mounted. Look, we are faced, we spent most of this program talking about things that I don't think are the prime issues that we face as a country. We face a competition internationally from China, from Russia, from Iran. It is an axis of evil, and it's intended to suggest, they plainly say, that the approach of the Western democracies, and I include in that Japan and South Korea and others, but the approach of the West of free speech, of the rights of individuals, of freedom of commerce, of not having a government control over every aspect of our lives. They believe the totalitarian approach that they are pursuing is the right way. They think democracies are weak. They think that we are incapable of dealing with the pressures and the outside pressures that they bring about. And I think that it's vitally important that Americans, regardless of your political persuasion, understand fully the threats that we're facing to our way of life and our system of government from these forces that are out there. And standing up to Putin in Ukraine, which also means standing up to Iran, which is supplying a lot of the weapons, and to China, which is supplying a lot of the resources to Russia, it's vitally important we do that because, as we've seen in the last century, when democracies sat back and did not do anything, the catastrophe that resulted in World War II, there is no doubt in my mind that Putin, if he succeeds in taking over Ukraine or installing a puppet government in Ukraine, will bring similar pressure on the Baltic states, on other states in Eastern Europe, and because he wants to resurrect the old Soviet empire, and that is not in our national interest to allow him to do so.
I think this goes without saying, but you would have voted for this package.
Without a doubt. I would have been vocally. In fact, I and other former members and national security officials issued an open letter on Friday supporting the aid to Ukraine. Former Governor Pataki and I, along with seven other former Republican members from New York, supported Ukraine back in February, saying that we should move forward. And I'm glad that this was finally done.
So since the name was raised before, let me ask House Speaker Mike Johnson, House Majority Leader Steve Scalise, and House Majority Whip Tom Emmer all voted with Democrats to advance this legislation. Elise Stefanik did not, has not been among those in the House GOP conference to approve this and voted against this legislation. Why do you think that was the case?
I don't know. I haven't talked to her about it. I don't agree with that vote. And mind you, there were four pieces of legislation voted on Saturday. One was Israel, one was Ukraine, one was the Indo-Pacific, and a fourth dealt with things like TikTok and some other matters. And ultimately, the final package, Elise Stefanik voted for, and so did most of the other Republicans. We have a small fringe on the right, just as the Dems have a fringe on their left, which, frankly, I find those views to be often ignorant and appalling. But the bottom line here is that aid is going to go to Ukraine. I hope it's going to be in time. And we should look, these people are fighting for their own independence and they're willing to shed their blood to do it. And it's our privilege to support them defending their own freedom.
Mark.
I was very interested to hear today when I looked at the European press and takes on this, they are even more exuberant than we are in the United States. And that's always an important sign when the folks that are sort of closer to the enemy are just as happy, if not happier, than we are, that we're doing something to keep them in check. I think this buys us about a year of time where the Ukrainians can continue to hold off the Russians. I think there are changes that need to be made, both in U.S. posture and within Ukraine, to fight this war differently. I think the administration needs to relax its constraints on how deep into Russia we allow the Ukrainians to strike. Whether we do that publicly or behind the scenes, I don't really care. I think they need to be allowed to strike deeper into Crimea, which is an important staging base for what happens in terms of the offensive maneuvers in Ukraine. I also think we actually ought to do what we can with long-range missiles, encourage the Germans to do the same despite their historic reluctance. We need to make good use of this time. And we also need to think about how efficiently to train the Ukrainian troops, perhaps instead of moving them out to foreign countries like Poland, perhaps we figure out a way to get trainers into safe parts of Ukraine to try and expedite that whole process. The Ukrainians also need to do a better job in terms of conscripting and paying their military. I think it'll be a heck of a lot easier to do that once now you can tell somebody that you're going to send them to the front line, ask them to hold off the Russians, and now they're actually going to have bullets and artillery shells with which to do that. And I think also Mr. Zelensky needs to be more forward thinking about digging in his defenses. I think there's been some reported reluctance on the part of the Ukrainians to do that because he didn't want to harden the lines where the Russians now sit for fear that those would become perhaps the basis of discussions around what was left of Ukraine. But I think practically he needs to concede to that point. It's too bad. I think it's inexcusable that it took the Republicans this long. I think there are severe consequences to that. I think any credible threat of us getting involved in China is gone. Because of the, so long as this political situation remains as it is, but I'm glad they did the right thing in the end.
That is interesting, John, as to why it did take so long, and your thoughts on that.
Well, it took long because there was real disagreement in Republican ranks, and some of the disagreement is we don't want to help Ukraine because we have to have items here at home like the border to deal with. Other aspects of the reluctance was, and I think there's some justification in this, the Biden administration has not clearly articulated a message about what's at stake to the United States. And the president has started to do that, but I think his reluctance has been in terms of sending them the type of weaponry that they could really use to be effective, longer-range missiles, F-16s. I've been calling for F-16s for 2 years now to go to Ukraine. So I think there's been a reluctance because they were saying, oh, well, this might encourage the Russians to react more severely, et cetera. And I don't think that approach is really going to get the attention of Vladimir Putin. I think we need to give them everything we can to defeat the Russians and to thwart their advances. And I think hopefully we can forge a bipartisan consensus that the public understands as to what's truly at stake here.
And, you know, what the guy did is he handed in his homework, but he did it late. And at most schools, and for most subjects, if you hand in your homework late, you only get half credit. And one quote that I really stuck with is, the U.S. general overseeing military operations in Europe says, the side that can't shoot back more than not loses.
Right.
It's true. And one of the things that this has exposed is the deficiencies in our defense industrial base. We're not producing enough munitions and missiles, for instance, that we truly need in order to deal with the threats that we have. Part of the reason is we are now spending more in interest on our budget than we're spending on defense. Over $800 billion in interest costs to pay our debt. And that is a calamitous financial situation for the country that we really need to address.
John, you and I are in league on a lot of this, but I do want to point out, I think it's incorrect to say that we should give the Republicans a pass on taking so long because Joe Biden didn't hold enough tutorial sessions. I think that's a silly argument. That's not what happened here.
Sparta, I was reading about Sparta. They did something really smart. When somebody was facing off against their enemies, they actually gave them some of their military generals to help them out here. And I mean, we don't even have to directly fight the Russians. We just have to give people guns.
Well, we're out of time. So you get the last word, George. Congratulations.
Yeah, great to be with that. Great to be with George today.
We'll be with that. My thanks to everybody. Thanks to Libby, who had to leave early. John Faso, thank you as always. Mark Whitman, George, thank you for being part of the proceedings. We will continue. Just a reminder, a special on Earth Day coming up at 11 o'clock. First, this.